Hello, and welcome to a very special episode of Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fried Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me for this said special episode is my pal and friend to the network and friend to humanity in general, Dr. Ange. Hi, Ange.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for inviting me to this show. I have to say I don't always comment, but I always listen, and I always find it very fascinating.
Thank you very much. I have wanted to have you on the show for quite a while, and we talked about other things we wanted to do, but this was something that I always said, if I am ever going to cover this, I wanted you to be there with me, because namely, we're here to talk, again, if anybody saw the show notes, you know what we're here to talk about. Instead of a person's career, for this, again, it's a special episode, we're kind of breaking the format a little, we're here to talk about a documentary about movies, namely, A Personal Journey with Martin Scorsese Through American Movies. What a handle for this movie. It came out in 1995, originally in the United Kingdom, which means it is now celebrating its 30th birthday. And this is something that, of all my friends, I know people, other people out there in sort of the greater film community know this thing. But in terms of my friends, you, Ange, are the only person I know that's seen this. And also loves it the way I do. And it's been something I've always wanted to celebrate and talk about on the show because it really did inform my love of movies as an art form. And I just figured, you know what? Now that, again, there's a new Martin Scorsese documentary out on Apple called Mr. Scorsese, 5 hours long. I have not gotten to it yet. But I really want to watch it. And we always plan to do this for its 30th anniversary. So I thought, why not? Let's do it now. So let's start at the, before we even talk about the documentary, where are you on Martin Scorsese as a filmmaker? Now, obviously, anyone with a half-functioning brain knows he's one of the greatest filmmakers ever to live. But where, how does his films land with you personally? Like, are you a giant fan? Is it some stuff, not others? Do you see everything he puts out? Where's your sort of baseline on Scorsese's films?
Yeah, I'll say, obviously, like you say, he's a genius. And I will say when he hits with me, he hits big. Movies that there's no movie that I ever say like, oh, that was OK. Like if it hits me, it works exceptionally well and it's great. There are some movies of his that just don't hit me the same way. But I will say that whatever he does, I do my best to see. Now, I will say, I feel like his last several movies have all been like 3+ hours. and I don't think, like, there were some movies that I feel, or some creators that I feel, oh, I can watch this piecemeal and, like, you know, I'll watch a half an hour and then I'll go to work and then I'll watch half an hour and I'll iron shirts. And I feel with him, you sort of have to sit down and dedicate. Yeah. And it's getting harder and harder these days to like dedicate, like I am going to have 3 hours in front of the television with my phone off to like really soak this in. Right. So I'll say like, I still haven't seen Killers of the Flower Moon be for that very reason. Mm-hmm. But he's one of those, like, I feel like there are some people like, you know, Ridley Scott, Martin Scorsese, I would say Steven Soderbergh in many ways, are sort of people that I see like, oh, they're making a movie. I definitely should see this because more often than not, they're great. And I can rattle off all of the ones that I love from Scorsese, or maybe we're saving that for later.
Well, okay, let's do it now. What are some of your favorites of this?
Well, I'll say that, you know, if you ask me, like, what is my Scorsese comfort food? It's Goodfellas.
Goodfellas,
right? If there's any movie that I can be like, oh, I'm going to be washing the dishes and I'll have something on television that's Martin Scorsese, it's Goodfellas. I've seen it a million times. Like, and it's that sort of. In many ways, it's akin to The Godfather in that way. Like, if I'm scrolling up and down the you know my cable channels and Goodfellas is on, I will probably stop. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I would say it's my favorite film, right? I'm a Michael Caine person. There are movies and films, right? So I think Taxi Driver is probably like, what do I feel is like a great Scorsese experience? I would say Taxi Driver. It was probably like the first Scorsese movie that I saw and it struck me as so powerful and raw that I feel that that's probably my, if you ask me what's my favorite, I would probably say that. But
interesting. Okay.
Go ahead.
No, that's interesting. I find that because I will admit this, I appreciate Taxi Driver for the masterpiece that it is, but I find it such an unpleasant watch that it is not something that I watch hardly ever. If I think I've seen it twice and then I'm kind of like, yeah, I think I'm good because it's so bleak and so dark that I just kind of go, oh, all right.
You're exactly right. I think, like, honestly, I meant it when I said it was probably the first Scorsese movie that I saw. Like, when I was like 17 or 18, I was starting to think like, oh, I'm a film guy. I'm gonna like watch all of these classic movies, right? Like, and that was, I had always heard about Taxi Driver. I rented it and I was like, whoa, bleak, like incredible, right? The voiceover, Travis Bickle is crazy. The ending, I think it lands so well. But that is not something that if I'm scrolling up and down on the television, oh, I'll watch Taxi Driver while I'm washing dishes. That is not that sort of category. So I would, but I also love The Departed. I like Shutter Island, I think more than a lot of people like Shutter Island. I like Cape Fear a lot. But there were others of his that I think are like, I think I've seen Raging Bull twice. I can't sit through Raging Bull, I
That's
think,
another
because
one.
it's so visceral. It's just hard to watch, but that's also shows you like, man, if he's able to get that emotion out of me that it's, I'm cringing, it just shows how powerful he is and what he gets out of his actors.
I mean, I hate to be so obvious, but I'm speaking to my fellow Italian. The Goodfellas, man, is just it goes to, for such a classic. Again, I'm not saying anything to anybody doesn't already know, but for such a classic, it goes down like candy. It's so charming and seemingly effortless, and of course it's not, but it feels that way. And as you say, because it's the, I think because of the slight episodic nature, you can put it on at any point and just get right back into the hook of it. And for all of his movies, that one has bled, no pun intended, bled the most into like my daily life, where it's like any time it's, well, we're in Florida, we don't get cold, but when we if we ever had like a cold day, I'm always saying, by the time they unfroze Johnny Carbone, it took the, like, or we talk about Johnny Roast Beef or Johnny Two Times or whatever. Like, there's so many things that we've just my wife and I have incorporated into our language from that movie, and it is just so, just it just goes down. It's so easy to watch for a movie that's 2 hours and like 35 minutes. It's amazing how much it just slides by. And so, yeah, that one is like, it's got all the Scorsese grit and drama, but yet it is not, it's just not unpleasant to me the way some of the other ones are. Now, I will admit there are some of his more recent ones I have not seen, like Silence about the missionaries. I'm kind of like, oh God, that feels like homework a little bit. And I feel guilty about that because he is one of the greatest living filmmakers alive. And, there's only going to be so many Martin Scorsese movies. And you're like, well, I should see every one. Now, my wife and I did go see Killers of the Flower Moon for the exact reason you were talking about, right? Which was, this thing is almost 4 hours. I'm never going to watch this at home and stay focused. I'm just not, the dog's going to want to go for a walk. Like, there's just no way. So we were like, we're seeing this in the theater. That's it. And I'm glad I did because now it's like, when am I? And then people would, I'd run into people afterwards, like, should I see it? I'm like, if you're gonna see it, go see it in a theater because it's gonna be a tough, just tough to stay focused like that. Is there one of his that you've been dying to see and you just haven't gotten around to? You just mentioned Killers of the Flower Moon, but is there another one from his back catalog that you're like, how have I not seen that one yet?
Yeah, can I tell you, I have started Gangs of New York probably like six times. I have gotten, but it's on television. I'm like, this time I'm going to do it. You get about 45 minutes in, and then it's like, oh, somebody calls me or something like that. And then it's like, you just don't get back to it. So how that one I have missed, I have no idea. So that's probably the one. And I haven't seen The Irishman, which I heard was also very good.
I was all right with it. I didn't love it. That's another long one, but that's yeah.
And go ahead.
I'm just gonna say I have not seen New York, New York, his
Oh.
musical. And part of it is that it's not streaming anywhere. So if I'm going to get it, I have to buy a disc, which is fine. I have lots of discs, but I mean, I have to make that commitment. But the idea of like a Martin Scorsese musical, which is a tribute to the films of Vincent Minnelli, and it stars Liza Minnelli and Robert De Niro post Taxi Driver. I'm like, that sounds amazing. And I just have never had the opportunity, the presence of mind to buy the disc. And then once I get it, all right, I'm going to sit and watch this. So that one is to me the one glaring hole in his filmography, because I've seen Mean Streets, I've seen Taxi Driver, I've seen After Hours, I've seen, all that. But that one is still Raging Bull, but that one is still a king of comedy. But that one is like the one skip. And every time I bump across it in a IMDb or something, I go, why have I not watched that yet?
Can I tell you a funny story? Is that literally I watched that last week because
Wow.
I had taped it, taped. I had put it on my DVR off of TCM a while back, and my DVR was almost filled, and I was like, I got to start getting rid of some of these things. And so that was one of the one that I watched, which is crazy because it's De Niro as like a semi-suave jazz saxophone
Right,
player,
right, right. That sounds
right? And
crazy.
she plays like a big band crooner, and it's about how they have these two musical careers that don't always jibe, and how ultimately they sort of like end up like separating in their lives. But it's crazy. You don't think of Martin Scorsese as doing a musical, and m maybe worth seeing if it's free. But I don't know if I would,
Oh, okay.
if I paid $25 for it, I think I might have been like, what am I doing here?
Okay. All right. That's fair. That's fair.
But fascinating. And the one thing that I learned from that is that the song New York, New York was written for that movie. So, like the Sinatra starts spreading the news, that is from that movie. And at least in the TCM intro, they said was written for that movie. I don't know if that's true or not,
Really? I thought that song was older than that.
I
That's.
thought that song was older as well. Like the first thing I did was like text my girlfriend, like, I just saw the craziest movie and I learned the craziest thing, right? So
All
wild.
right. Okay. All right. Well, I someday I'm gonna have to check that out. So this documentary, The Personal Journey, by any way, anyone listening who's not familiar with it, unfortunately, it is not available on Blu-ray. It is only available still on DVD, and the only streaming channel that runs it is Canopy, which is the free service that you can get through if you have a library card. And I recommend anybody who has a library card get Canopy, because there is a lifetime's worth of great entertainment in there, and it is all free. And this thing is on there, and it's been on. I mean, stuff comes and goes on every streaming channel. I put this thing on my favorites list on Canopy when we first got Canopy 5 years ago, and it's still there. It's still so Canopy's never gotten rid of it. So that's I always feel like okay. And now I will say I've never gotten rid of my. I still have it on DVD because I'm still afraid that Canopy's going to get rid of it one day. This thing runs 225 minutes, so it is almost 4 hours long. And it is broken down into essentially three parts. After an intro from Mr. Scorsese, which we'll talk about in a moment, he sort of sets up the director. It's all from naturally, the point of view of a director, of like, what is it like to sort of be a director in Hollywood? And he sets it up with the director's dilemma in that, what kind of career are you setting yourself out to have when financial concerns are always going to be part of it? And so after he does this intro, he sets up the director as storyteller, which he breaks down into genres. And then there's the part two, the director as illusionist, the director as smuggler. Again, we'll talk about what all that means in a moment. And then part three, the director as smuggler some more, and then the director as iconoclast. And it ends with a little concluding piece with Scorsese. And again, he is the only, other than clips, he is the only person we see on screen. He's in a chair and the camera is incredibly close up on him. And so, do you remember when you first saw, do you remember how you saw this for the first time?
I owe it all to you because I think that you sent me this set of DVDs. You had talked about it. And I was like, man, that sounds like super fascinating. I would be so interested in hearing it. So I've actually come to this late. I would say probably within the last 5 years or so, whenever you gifted it to me is when I first saw it, which is fascinating because, of course, I'm like so immersed into TCM that I've seen a fair number of the movies that he talks about through this, but there is a whole swath of ones that I haven't seen. And you just start writing down these names, like, if I ever see this movie, I'm going to have to sort of watch this because this sounds so fascinating to me. But I think it's great because he also says, like, this is my personal journey. So I'm going to tell you about these oddball things that struck me as being like incredibly cool that other people might not think is incredibly cool, but you know, this is just me talking about it. And obviously he knows what he's talking about. So everything that he shows you, you're like, oh, like I'm learning here, but in a very entertaining way.
That, yes, I'm glad you brought that up, because that to me is the hook of this, is that it is not a documentary where we got to cover all the greats, right? We're going to do a history of film, and that means we're going to talk about Orson Welles and Alfred Hitchcock and Stanley Kubrick and Woody Allen. I mean, obviously the great masters, but no, this is, I mean, hence the title, A Personal Journey. This is what he finds interesting to talk about, because he's sort of saying, and he even talks about that a lot of these films, a lot of these directors fell through the cracks of the system as the Hollywood system was in place the way it was in the silent era. It goes all the way around from the silent era up until basically the late 60s. And then he finally says, well, now we're up to the era where I was making films and I feel like I can't quite have it with the same critical eye. He tells this amazing anecdote at the very beginning. Now, of course, we know Martin Scorsese is an actor. He's actually been in quite a few things as a performer. And as a director, he's a very good actor. Right. He's very funny. Yeah. And he's been in he's in Killers of the Flower Moon. He's been in a film by Albert Brooks, one of my all time favorites. He's in that film. He's been in he was in a movie called Guilty by Suspicion with Robert De Niro. So he's been in he was just recently in the first season of The Studio playing himself. And so he tells this amazing story where he says as a child, he got a book from the New York Public Library, and it was like I forget, it's by Joseph Deems, I think the guy's name, and he talks about this, it's a pictorial history of the movies that he got in like the 50s when he's a kid, and the camera's right in his face, and he says, you know, these were the only images I could get of some of these movies, because obviously there's no home video at this point, and unless you caught them on television, they're kind of lost art. And he's like, a lot of times I was tempted to cut the images out of the book just to keep them. And he says, of course, that's a terrible impulse because this is a book from the New York Public Library. And then there's this great pause and he kind of like licks his lips and he's like, I admit, sometimes I gave into that impulse a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so charming. You're like, I'm on his side that he's admitting that he cut up a book from the New York Public Library because he just wanted to have a still from a movie that he really wanted to see. It's such a great way to open a documentary.
Yeah, and I would love to know, like, just one. Like, I sat there and said, like, I wonder what movie captivated him so much in elementary school that he cut up. You know, maybe it's like the original Fly.
It's so good. Maybe not only Martin Scorsese, but maybe that's the reason why this thing to me is so compelling, is because there aren't that many like this where it is from his particular point of view. It is not meant to be omniscient or objective. It is like, no, this is the stuff. And he's, you know, like it opens with him talking about going with his mother to see Duel in the Sun, because his mother wanted to see this movie and he wanted to go see, because we heard it was like this sort of AKA Lust in the Dust, this sort of lusty Western. And she drags her little son along because he likes Westerns. And he talks about how sort of puzzled he was by it, by some of the themes in it. And so right there, it's like, it's all from his particular point of view. And that is what makes it so compelling. And and we'll talk about this in a moment, but like this documentary creates the greatest mental cue list you could possibly imagine. Because when I first saw it, and it's funny, my memory of it is that I saw it, I rented it from Movies Unlimited when I worked there. I don't know if that's accurate because it didn't get released in the US until 1998. So I don't know if it actually, and I was gone from the store by then. So I don't know if it got a DVD release before then. So I may be remembering it not correctly, but I do remember getting this and being like, wow, I'm being exposed to names and to films that I had never heard of. And the clips are so beautifully chosen that it makes you just say, God, I want to see virtually everything that he is showing in the, and the, you know, this thing has clips from several hundred movies, and it's there, you know, like, oh, I want to see this, I want to see this, I want to see this. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, and I think like we say, and we'll get to it, but there's like one clip from this Western that I've never heard of before that he's like, look at this tracking shot as this guy is like running through the town as he's trying to get to the church for sanctuary. And you say, in every other documentary, it's going to be, let's look at the tracking shot at the beginning of Touch of Evil by Orson
Right,
Welles, right? You
right.
know, but this is not that. This is like, boy, I saw this Western that me, Ange, has never heard of, right? And pointing out how great this shot is and how that leads to the climax of that film. And so it's like you say, it's like, boy, this is a shopping list of things that, hey, if Scorsese says this is good, it must be real good, right? You know, I'm going to write this down and try to, you know, make sure that I catch up. And it's from the, like, he rattles off silent movies. I am not a big silent movie guy, but I wrote down a bunch of silent movies that he talked about because I'm like, if I ever run across this one, sounds too good, right? Like, you know, maybe time to check it out.
Right. So, okay. Part one, he talks about, again, it's more the how a director works in Hollywood and how they are able to, can they balance this career? And it actually, it opens with The Bad and the Beautiful, which is directed by the aforementioned Vincent Minnelli, which at the time I had never seen. I didn't know that it was about Hollywood, and it's about Kirk Douglas and Barry Sullivan playing these aspiring writer director, and they're trying to get a leg up in Hollywood. And it's sort of a little bit of the story of Val Lewton, because there's like a reference to sort of the cat people and stuff like that. And so that's the opening of it. Now, what in the, like, say in the early section, we got what you already mentioned, the one with the tracking shot, which I believe is Colorado Territory, directed by Raoul Walsh, where where he shows that tracking shot. I believe that's the film he's talking about. What were some of the ones that he shows in this movie that you then went on to go see? What are just a couple of those?
Let me get there. So, sorry as I vamp.
No. Oh, you know what? I'll do one. I'll do one first. One of the early ones, he shows a clip from the movie called The Phoenix City Story, which is
Oh,
a
yeah.
film noir, which has one of the most brutal clips imaginable, where these bunch of like Klan members grab a little African American girl off they literally grab her off the street, and then they cut to the car going by the house of like this local, I think it's like an attorney, I forget what his position is, but he's not on board with this town's view of you know how racist this town is, and they literally throw the body of the dead black girl out of the car, and it lands on the lawn in front of this guy's two children with a note attached to her chest saying, like, you're next or your family is next. And it is so brutal. And you can't believe it's like from a 1955 movie. And that was one that I went and searched out. And that is a great movie. The Phoenix City Story is a great, by the way, Phoenix is spelled with no O, Phoenix. So it's like, if you try and do like an SEO on it, you can't find it because it's not spelling Phoenix the way you expect. But that was one that I saw the clip and I went, what is this movie? And I went and found it. And it is, you know, it's a fantastic, rather lesser known film noir.
Yeah, that's one of the ones that I put in the list of like, which ones haven't I seen that I should see? Because that clip that they show is
Oh.
unbelievably compelling. I mean, it's crazy. I searched out two Edward G. Robinson movies. One, The Red House, which is, if
Okay.
you've ever seen that,
I've still
is
not
like,
seen that.
is like pretty wild about he plays somebody that's pretty crazy and doesn't want his daughter to go to this red house in the woods. And he's got a lot of issues. And then Scarlet Street, which is a Fritz Lang film noir with him and Dan Duryea and Joan Bennett, which they made after The Woman in the Window, which was the same three, where he plays a henpecked husband.
Yes.
Where Joan Bennett is sort of like using him, and he thinks he's going to divorce his wife and marry Joan Bennett, and then everything goes awry. And so seeing that, you just see the life that he has. They have a clip of him at home where he's just being completely henpecked by his wife. And
I like that he's got a woman's apron on.
He's got an apron on, and he's like, I bought a nice piece of liver that I'm going to make for dinner, right? And then he goes to Joan Bennett and is like, I'm going to divorce my wife and marry you. She's just unbelievably beautiful, and she laughs at him. And you go, boy, like, this is not a pleasant life that this guy has. I can understand why, like, I can only imagine how this movie ends, and then it ends that way. So those were two. There's a whole list of ones that I sort of wrote, like Johnny Guitar, which, like, Joan Crawford in this weird Western was another one that I was like, what is this even about? The colors look garish. So I said, like, I got to look at Johnny Guitar, which has Sterling Hayden in it, too.
Yeah,
like,
pretty, yep.
But it is this laundry list of stuff. Like, there were many that I've seen, and then there's many more that I haven't.
I shamelessly admit I bought Johnny Guitar on Apple, my Apple TV account, when it was on sale for $4.99, and I still have not yet watched it. It's been sitting in that account because I was like, for $4.99, like, you know, if I ever want to rent it, it's going to be $3.99. So I'm another dollar, I'll own it forever. And just as a side note, I know people say, yeah, you know, you don't really own the movies when you buy them digitally. I will say I have had hundreds of films in my Apple TV account for better part of 15 years now, and not a single film has ever disappeared. So I just don't worry about that a whole lot because, I mean, I've got hundreds and hundreds of things in there. You talk about that clip from Colorado Territory, that tracking shot, which is amazing. And he opens it. The director of storyteller section is broken down by genre. So it opens with Westerns because obviously that is one of the pure American art forms. And there's even a clip of Clint Eastwood talking about how the Western is like jazz. And another example, which he doesn't mention, but you and I close to our heart, is the comic book, which is an American creation. Yeah. And Clint Eastwood talks about that Americans can be very blasé about their own art form sometimes. So, and they even show a clip from Unforgiven. And there is an absolutely brutal clip from a documentary about John Ford.
Yeah,
he is being interviewed by young Peter Bogdanovich, and John Ford at that point has got the eye patch. He looks like he's 500 years old, and Bogdanovich is trying to get information out of John Ford, and John Ford is having none of it. And it is the most like, every time that clip comes up in the documentary, I wince a little because it's so uncomfortable. Where he's like, you know. I feel like that your view of the Westerns have gotten more pessimistic over time. Do you agree with that assessment? He's like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, now that I pointed it out, do you want to talk about it? No, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like, it was like, why did you subject yourself to the interview if you don't want to answer my questions?
And then he just says, cut.
Cut.
He's like, cut. Right. You know, in my notes, I just wrote John Ford. Ornery son of a bitch.
Oh, my God.
It's very clear he does not want to be asked questions like this.
It is unbelievable. So from the Western section, one of the films that he shows that I finally watched just recently is a Western called The Furies with Barbara Stanwyck, which is directed by Anthony Mann. And the scene that he shows is where Barbara Stanwyck is in love with this Mexican, and her father has him executed. Has him hung in front of her, and as she sort of rides off, because the guy says, you know, basically take off, you know, I don't want you to see me get killed like this, you hear him scream, and then she runs into her father and she says something to the effect of, you know, I didn't think I could ever hate someone as much as I hate you, and I'm going to spend the rest of my life making sure that I bring down your world around you. And it's an amazing clip. And I finally watched it a couple of months ago. And damn it, it's a fantastic movie. It's an absolutely great movie.
Yeah, that's on my list of like things that I haven't seen that I got to do, because again, that is a wild scene. And Stanwyck never fails. She's always excellent in everything.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I think the thing that always gets me is Scorsese says it is like, the Western is often a parable for like what's happening in, the real world. And he talks about John Wayne in Stagecoach and John Wayne in The Searchers and how they're both done by John Ford. They both star John Wayne. They're both in the same location. What different movies. And he says, he rescues Natalie Wood, but you don't know, he might kill Natalie Wood, right? And how he is the worst character. He's supposed to be like the protagonist. He's the worst character in the film. And I'm always floored by The Searchers when I watch it, but to hear him sort of distill it as, compare it to, what was the other one that he said, like tie a yellow ribbon
She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. Yeah.
She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. And about how each of those is like the same director, the same actor, the same location, three different periods in American history, three very different Westerns, all talking about what is happening in the world. It's just brilliant.
And the clip they show from The Searchers, I mean, I've seen The Searchers a couple times, but the clip they show, if you've never seen it, makes it so brutal, because it's they find this dead Indian, and John Wayne's character shoots his eyes out, and they're like, why did you do that? And he's like, what was the point of that? And he's like, well, for you it doesn't mean anything, but to that guy it means that without his eyes he's gonna forever wander the spirit world because he doesn't have his eyes to see. And it's like, it's brutal. It's a brutal clip. You're like, wow, John Wayne's a friggin' dick in that movie. Like, my God.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So awesome.
He shows another clip from a movie that I still have not seen, a Western called The Tall T, which is directed by Bud Bedeker, which again, this is one of the things I love about this documentary, is that he is highlighting directors that outside of the Criterion Collection or outside of TCM are kind of forgotten. I mean, nobody really remembers Bud Bedeker. The average even movie fan doesn't know Bud Bedeker. And there is an amazing scene that he shows with Randolph Scott, who did a bunch of Bud Bedeker movies. And it's him and the bad guy, and they're talking, and they're having this pretty deep philosophical conversation kind of about manhood, right? And it's just like, it's sort of startling that it's this gentle conversation, contrary to what I just talked about with the John Wayne thing and The Searchers. It's this very, very gentle conversation between these two tough guys kind of about, your life. And he's like, well, a man shouldn't be alone. He should have a woman. And it's like, you're like, wow, this is incredibly sensitive in what was ostensibly sort of like a programmer Western. And it's something I've always wanted to see. And it's just on the list of like, I just have not gotten around to it yet.
For sure. I had never heard of that one before this as well. And I think he makes a point like, this is like the good guy and the bad guy who suddenly realize they're not that different as they're sort of like traveling across the country, which makes it, it's not like these are friends. These are actually like enemies that are having this conversation over like, a pot of beans heating up on a fire,
Right. So. Yep. So he moves on. After that, he goes on from Westerns to the gangster film, which I was a little more familiar with. He shows a clip from Scarface and talks about Howard Hawks's editing, where there's this scene where the Boris Karloff's character, Boris Karloff, God, Boris Karloff is in that movie. And he is at a bowling alley, and we see him lining up a shot, and then he throws the ball, and the camera follows the ball, but you hear the sound of gunshots as the Boris Karloff's character is getting shot to death, but we're following the ball as it hits the pins, and it makes this sort of cacophony of sound. And he's talking about the filmmaking style of that. And that's a great movie. I've seen that a couple of times. Now, he showed a clip from another one called I Walk Alone with Kirk Douglas and Burt Lancaster. And have you seen I Walk Alone?
Yeah, and I have to say it's great, because so many of these, like, there's actually a whole part about film noir, and TCM every Sunday morning has a film noir hosted by
Eddie Muller.
Eddie Muller, and this was one of the ones that he showed. And so I was like, oh, I know this scene from this documentary.
It's a great moment because the setup is that Burt Lancaster was part of this kind of low-key mob, and he got busted and he went off to jail. And while he's in jail, his other criminal cronies have kind of, in the post-war world in America, gone legit. So now all of their criminal enterprises are kind of, quasi-official. They're kind of like actual companies. And this guy, now that it, so then Burt Lancaster comes out of prison and he wants to kind of go right back to life, and they're back to his life. And they're like, well, no, Frankie, that's not the way we do things anymore. And they're talking about holding companies and, a board of directors. And Burt Lancaster's character is getting madder and madder and madder. And it's funny, I had never seen that film. I finally got the Blu-ray of it about a year ago, watched it, and I loved it. And then I listened to the commentary, and the commentary was by film historian Troy Howarth. And I loved it so much that I went and found other commentaries by him. And then I reached out to him, and then he ended up being on Fade Out last year. So it all, thanks to
Well,
the documentary, it all worked out.
that scene is great because the character actor who's the accountant has been in a million things. He's
The guy
one of
from Rear
those
Window.
guys.
He's from Rear
Yeah, correct.
Window.
Yeah. And he's talking about like, well, so Burt Lancaster is saying like, Kirk Douglas is in charge, right? Yeah. Okay, well, like, so he makes all the decisions. Well, the board of directors of this corporation, which is a holding company for that corporation, and Lancaster like throws the pen across the room, right? He's talking like a different language. And Kirk Douglas is basically like, your time has passed. You got to get out of here. Very, very tense scene. So great.
He's like, a couple of years ago, you might have been able to make the switch, but now you're just a relic because the world has changed much too much. I love it. I love Burt Lancaster. Stop the double talk. I love all that. We talked about that just in the last episode with about Burt Lancaster, that Lancaster was a smart guy who could play a dumb guy really well. He was capable of kind of like deadening his eyes a little and play a dumb guy. And so that's a fantastic clip. They show another great moment from Force of Evil, a film noir directed by Abraham Polanski, who was one of the, and it stars John Garfield. Polanski got blacklisted, and this film talks about sort of as like a veiled, not reference to that kind of the way America was turning in the late 1940s. I went and finally saw that. I own the Blu-ray. That's another absolutely fantastic movie, and it shows this scene that's shot where they're somewhere in New York, and they're at this, like, it looks like it's a quarry almost, except it's got a stairwell, and it's like it. You see the figure in it, and you're like, my God, this stairwell that Garfield is walking down, it must be 60 feet high. It must be 70 feet high. You're like, where the hell did they find this? And it's just such a startling image to see.
And it's obvious, like I think his brother is dead, and I actually think at the end of the movie maybe his brother's in the water at the bottom of those stairs or
I
something. But
think
there's
so,
definitely
yeah.
like a I think there's definitely like a he is descending into hell, right? Because he's a lawyer who's corrupt. And that movie also has that great scene where there's like this nebbish guy who's like, I just want to be out of the mob. I just want to be out of the mob. I can't do this anymore. And to get out of the mob, he set up another mobster. And then they end up killing that guy. It really a point of view of the guy shoots him in the face, but you're from the point of view of that guy. So the gun is right at the camera. And you go, boy, that's a tough way to go. That's a great movie. You've talked about Garfield before. I mean, Garfield is wonderful in almost everything.
When that guy realizes that he's been double-crossed and he's like, what did you do? What did you do? Because he knows he's about to die. That's again, that's the thing I mentioned earlier, is that who I have to assume, Scorsese had a say in the clips, but I mean the editing of this thing, it was edited by Kenneth Lewis and David Lindblom. I'm not familiar with the other one. And then I think it was like overseen by Thelma Schoonmaker, who of course is Scorsese's longtime director. But they managed to find clips that highlight what Scorsese's talking about, but also make you just say, I have got to see this movie. I mean, what is this movie? And that's, the Herculean load of that, of going through an entire, again, I'm sure Scorsese knows a lot of this stuff from memory, but just the idea that you're like, what, we're going to watch Force of Evil, We're gonna watch this 100-minute movie and distill it down to 45 seconds. That's gonna make the point I want to make, and it's gonna be by it. And the scene is, it has a beginning, middle, and end. You know what I mean? Like, it tells its own little story with it. Even though you don't know the film and you don't know the setups, you immediately understand. Oh, this guy is this. This guy's turning the, and then again, then as you mentioned, like the gun in the face, it features this bravura shot that is so memorable. And it's just clip after clip of that. And that's what is so impressive of finding the exact right thing out of a 2-hour movie. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, I'll say much like that scene that you talked about with Boris Karloff in Scarface where sound happened. They show a shot from Public Enemy with Jimmy Cagney where he and his friends like hear a noise that sounds like gunshot and like and it's like, you know, tin cans coming out of a garbage can, and then literally half a second later it's actually real machine gun fire and they have to run and you just say, boy, that's like a perfect shot, right? Like they laugh at each other like, oh, we got fooled, and then that one guy's just shot dead, which is another great shot. It's so great.
He then moves on to the musical, and I will admit that when I saw this for the first time, again, it had, I tell myself it was 95, 96, maybe been a little later, but the musical was the one genre that I had not dismissed because I'd seen musicals, but I definitely was sort of like, eh, if it's a musical, I'm not terribly interested in it. Right. Cause I just thought they were all kind of like, when I thought of a musical, I thought of like Oklahoma, right? Or like State Fair. Like, I have since gone to see Oklahoma on the big screen, and it's a terrific movie. But I had this image of like, just, you know, that's just kind of like almost jazz hands kind of thing.
And I
was like, oh, all right. And then he shows a clip from Meet Me in St. Louis, where the young daughter, the youngest daughter, gets so upset that they're going to leave St. Louis. The father, Leon Ames, the great Leon Ames, has gotten a job in New York. And so him and all of his kids, he's got like 7 kids in that movie, are going to leave to go to New York. And the youngest daughter, Tootie, runs out and starts smashing the snowmen that she's made, which are figural representatives of her family. And she starts smashing them with a tree branch because she's so upset about the idea that she's going to leave the only home she's ever known, this wonderful, you know, St. Louis at the turn of the century. And I remembered watching that and going, that's from a musical?
Yeah.
That seemed really dark. And that, I was like, huh. And then he shows a clip from The Bandwagon.
Yeah.
Which is in Vincent Minnelli, another Vincent Minnelli movie, which is there's a musical number about film noir, about gangsters. Yeah. And I saw those two clips and I went, I'm missing something here, right? If it's good enough for Martin Scorsese, this is good enough for me. And I have since gone to, I've since seen Meet Me in St. Louis. I've seen it in the theater. I own it. And I've seen The Bandwagon, and I've seen My Dream Is Yours with Doris Day, directed by Michael Curtiz. And I'm like, oh, no. There are lots of great musical. Like, this documentary really opened that up for me.
You talked about Meet Me in St. Louis on Film and Water, right?
I did. I did an episode on it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that one's great. I haven't seen Bandwagon, but I got to tell you, the scene they show with Fred Astaire and Sid Charisse.
Oh, man.
I am missing something. So that was one of the ones that after watching it again for the show, I wrote down. The one that got me was, and I sought out to watch it after watching this documentary when you sent it to me a while ago, was I had never seen the James Mason Star Is Born. I had actually seen Frederick March version, and I had seen the Barbra Streisand version, but I had missed this middle one. And talk about like a cringeworthy, you know, the scene they show is her on stage singing and he is completely blotto. Yep. And he is trying to get him off the stage.
She's grabbing his arms and trying to like fake that he's not drunk. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And I was like, whoa, this, you know, I definitely have to see this because, you know, self-destructive story, which we know from the others. It spoke to me in a way that I was like, clearly Mason makes a meal out of this role and I have to sort of see it.
the scene of him pushing the reporter into the mirror is like brutal. Like, it's an incredible stunt. It's an incredible that he is like, because they're trying to, all these reporters are trying to like talk to him, and he's like, no, no, leave me alone, leave me alone. And then he finally just turns and pushes that one guy, and the mirror smashes into like 1,000 pieces. And you're like, what a stunt that was. Like, what an incredible piece. And the other, the My Dream Is Yours, it has this great clip. Again, I know I'm going to go on and on about these clips, but that's the way it is. With Doris Day, where it's her and her husband, and they're both singers, and they get married. And I think Doris Day, when they meet, is lower down in her career than her husband is, but it's clear because she's Doris Day, she's the one with the real talent, and she's starting to rise past him. And when they get married, he's like, well, you know, we can't have two careers in a marriage, so we'll focus on mine. You're like, wow.
Classic. But that's where Scorsese says that movie of two creative people is what led him to do New York. So I haven't seen this Doris Day movie, but it seems fascinating.
It is. It's really pretty good. And that scene is great.
Yeah, she seems luminous in that movie. I'm not the biggest Doris Day fan, but the clip they show, she's gorgeous. So
there's another great example of, like, I think by the time when I saw this documentary, I was like, Doris Day. I kind of know what a Doris Day movie is. Eh. And then I watched that clip and I'm like, oh, that's kind of dark. I didn't know Doris Day did stuff like that. You know what I mean? And so I was like, give her.
For
now
sure.
I've seen a bunch of Doris Day movies since then. Now, he does occasionally jump past his era, because he does in the musical section, he shows All That Jazz, a clip from All That Jazz, which I had not seen to that point. Now, have you seen All That Jazz?
I haven't seen All That Jazz.
That, like, masterpiece. Just masterpiece. And Roy Scheider, can't go wrong with Roy Scheider in the 70s, basically. I don't think there's a movie with him in the 70s is going to be bad. But what an incredible clip of him, of Roy Scheider playing Bob, basically playing Bob Fosse. The movie's directed by Bob Fosse. It's basically about himself, where he's dying in a hospital bed and he's directing himself.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's like, what's your line? He's like, he's
intubated.
Thank you. Yes. And he's like, oh, what's the line? And the script girl comes out and she's like, I want to live. I want to live. And he's like, well, if you can't get the line right, we'll just move on to the next setup. And it's so dark and brutal. Yeah. So all that I probably, of any section, the musical section is the one I learned the most from, in terms of, like, I haven't seen any of these and I got to check these out, you know?
Yeah.
By the way, in The Bandwagon, there's the guy sitting at the table, the gangster, and he's got the big scar on the one side of his face, and he's flipping a coin, and I'm like, that's Two-Face, right?
Yeah.
They clearly just took that from the Batman comics of the time. I couldn't believe it. So then he moves on to part two, which is the director as illusionist, which is this more of a broader idea of hiding things and hiding concepts and hiding ideas in his films. Now, of course, in this section, we get to Leave Her to Heaven, starring your eternal crush, Gene Tierney.
Yeah, it's a great thing, because I think what he's, he starts out by saying this was a new medium, and so people were just constantly experimenting, and that's how they created things that are illusions. And then he talks about how, like, color becomes important once color becomes a thing. And then, of course, Leave Her to Heaven is like a Technicolor film noir, right? With
so unusual.
And you know, I we may have talked about it when we talked about that movie, but, you know, the color of Gene Tierney's wardrobe, right, is like, you know, at one point she feels that she's hemmed in and she's in all browns, and then the next thing you see her, she's in this, like, blue, like, nightgown and things like that. And of course, they show the shot of the poor brother drowning and her just watching with
The
those
crippled
sunglasses
brother,
on.
the brother whose legs don't work, and he goes for a swim to build up his upper body, and she lets him drown.
Let him drown, and he comes up for one more time. He comes up out of the water after you think he drowns, and you're like, oh my God, save him. And then she watches him drown again. I mean, that is such a great movie. And to make that in color, I think it is a bold choice, right? That's a film noir. She's in like bright red lipstick, you know? So
It's an
amazing.
amazing. That's again, it's another where they're like, they found a scene that is, it goes from A to B to C. It's a complete thought.
Yeah.
It doesn't spoil the rest of the movie, but it tells you, oh, this is a film noir about an absolutely murderous
Yeah.
sociopath who just happens to look like Gene Tierney, which of course is going to paper over her sociopathy to most men. Because
Yes.
she looks like Gene Tierney. I mean, it would work on you. You would still know, but it would still work on you, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the first clip they show from that movie is her throwing herself down the stairs to, have herself miscarry, right? And so they're like, she's willing to kill her own baby, right? Or the baby she's carrying so that she'll be closer to her husband, which is a weird thing to say because she's a psychopath. But you're right, I still might be like, maybe it's worth it.
I can change her. I can. I know I can. Yeah. Again, that had been, I had never seen that movie until I saw this documentary and I was like, I got to see this. This just looks absolutely, absolutely amazing. So he does get into a lot of the technical stuff at this point where he mentions like that it's, it's kind of a shorthand that once sound came in, the camera stopped moving because he does do kind of a brief sojourn into silent films. And then it's
Yeah.
like, yeah, but the, you know, it that's, and he shows clips of like, well, that's actually not true, that some directors were actually quite innovative with the camera movements, even with sound. And he mentions a director named Tay Garnett, who again, kind of a forgotten director. I don't know if I've even seen a single one of his films, but shows this scene of in like a nightclub, and it's a guy who puts drinks on a, like a
Yeah.
waiter, and he puts drinks on a tray, and he walks through this crowded nightclub with hundreds of people going back, and the camera follows the guy through it with picking up sound the whole time. And you're like, well, yeah, there you go. Like you that's here's an incredibly fluid camera shot. And it's kind of like what you were talking about earlier, that most documentaries would show Touch of Evil, right? Because
Yeah.
that's the famous one. Or nowadays you'd even show Goodfellas at this point,
Yeah, for
or The
sure.
Player. But here, 1930. Here's
Yeah.
1930, and here's this Tay Garnett guy doing the very kinds of things. And it's, yeah, it's all this something like, I always kind of wonder, like, how did he remember that? Like, how
Yeah.
did he remember, like, this one film to, like, pull that clip for?
And part of me wonders, like, when I saw that scene when he showed it, I was like, I wonder if this is where he got the inspiration to do that Goodfellas shot, because that is Leota walking through a
Yep.
restaurant, and so maybe that was always tucked in his Rolodex, that he basically said, like, I want to recreate something like that.
Maybe so.
Yeah, can I say one thing?
Yeah.
When he's talking about the silent stuff, and again, it's all experimentation. I feel bad, like I haven't seen anything from D.W. Griffiths, which he's all over this
Yeah,
documentary.
he is.
But one of the things that he says is like, there's a movie that he directed that it's like one guy talking on the phone and the wife talking on the phone, and he's in like a restaurant and she's at the home, and that had never been done in a movie before. And the producers told Griffith, people are going to be confused. They're not going to be able to follow this, right? And you say, like, that's where movies were at one point, that the idea of like cutting from one character to another in two different places was unheard of at one point. And that's this whole illusion of the passing of time, right? She hears this guy get gunned down on the phone, which we've seen a million times, but that might have been the first time. So again, it just, he does such a great job of saying, like, back then people were like making it up as they went along and were doing a great job of it. That was the one thing that I was sort of floored by, things that we just take for granted now.
Right, yeah, they're building the language of film, and it's all just we're all just used to it at this point. But yeah, I mean, these guys are doing it for the first time. Like he mentions Sunrise by F.W. Murnau, which is the silence are is another, I want to call it a genre. The silence are not a genre, but it's an era of film that I am relative lesser familiar with than a lot of others. And he shows a scene where this couple are so in love and they're walking down the street, and he double exposes two different street scenes to where the cars, they appear to be driving into one another and the backgrounds are going into one, and yet this couple is walking through this and they're not being touched because they're in like a dream world of their own making. It's not a and he's talking about how that was new. That was a way to speak to the audience in a way they had not been spoken to before, that it's this isn't literal. And the audience has to figure out that this isn't literal. This is in their heads. And that is what he's putting across. And it's, yeah, these guys are coming up with this stuff for the first time, you know? And then he shows a shot from Some Came Running, starring Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin, which is like a personal favorite of mine. And it's like a movie that like nobody, not that many people really remember anymore, even though it's Shirley MacLaine and directed by Vincent Minnelli. And it's this long tracking shot through a carnival, and it's following our heroes, Sinatra and MacLaine, as there's a guy and a gunman chasing them. And have you ever seen that? Ever seen Sun Came
I've
Running?
never seen it. I've never seen it again, written down to look for.
Absolutely great movie. And Dean Martin's so good in it. And so again, and he's talk, and then he gets into the in the second part of that section where he's saying, then widescreen comes in. And some directors are like, I think he has a quote. I forget what director has the quote, but he's like, it's only good for funerals or snakes. And then he shows that no, other directors recognized that you could do a lot with widescreen. And he shows a clip from like East of Eden, which is just a character drama that takes place all in a room, and yet it's widescreen, you know? And it's kind of funny. It was like a couple of years ago, or oh my God, 10 years ago at this point, when Quentin Tarantino did The Hateful Eight in 70 millimeter, that movie almost takes entirely inside of a cabin, right? It's not these grand vistas. It's just a bunch, and yet he's using the 70 millimeter frame to its, to, you know, to its effectiveness. And so he has a bunch of those clips, which is again fantastic. So there's one other part of it that I want to ask you about because I'm fascinated by this. He gets into digital, right? And there's a clip from the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles where they show what they can do, and we see the young Indiana Jones, and then they digitally remove the guy behind him to show that what digital can do. And there's a clip from Brian De Palma and Francis Ford Coppola who says it is, you know, digital is the technology is a way to create the art, but it's a way to get the art across, but it's not the creation of the art. But there's this clip from George Lucas, right, where he talks about you can't make epics anymore, right? You can't make these epics with have that have 1,000 extras out in the desert. And so it's all got to be done digitally. And, you know, we all have our feelings about that because, you know, I feel like we all know George Lucas, I think, fell too in love with the technology. But what I'm fascinated is like when he's like, you can't afford to do that anymore. And I'm like, I've always wondered why. Why? Like, movies made money in the 50s. Why can't you do it? I don't like, it's not like movies were charities in the 50s. So yes, it was expensive to make those films, but it was expensive in 1950s money. So why can't you do it now? And I've never understood that. Like, what is it about the way movies are made that you can't get 1,000 people out into the desert when you could in 1955?
I mean, I think the only thing that I can think of is when you watch the credits in old movies, it's like nine names. When you watch the credits in movies now, it's like 5 minutes of all of these people that are sort of working on the production of the film. And so is so much money be going there?
I
But
guess, yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, Braveheart had a lot of people,
Yeah.
right? So I think maybe you're right. I think maybe he is transferring his own love of digital on top of what he's saying.
Yeah, and it shows, like, it gives an example of what he's talking about, where it takes a piece of, like a Busby Berkeley musical, of a bunch of people, women dancing, and it copies it into a perfect circle and then duplicates it in a smaller circle. So that way it's really only five women dancing, but it looks like it's 50. And you look at that and you go, yeah, but that doesn't look real then, because it's too perfect. It's too in sync. It's too, you know. And so again, someone who's listening to this who understands how movie budgets work, how could they make Ben-Hur in the 50s? Because it cost a lot back then. So why can't you do it now? I don't understand. He does show a scene from 2001, A Space Odyssey, which again is like butting right up against the sort of era of Scorsese. Yeah. He then moves on to the director as smuggler, which is the idea of a director sneaking in ideas under the guise of genre that, you know, nobody thought you could do, but these really talented people do it. And he starts it off with Val Lewton with Cat People and Val Lewton with I Walked with a Zombie, Max Ophuls and Letter from an Unknown Woman, which is features this incredible scene with Louis Jourdan where he's talking to, I think it's Joan Fontaine.
Joan Fontaine.
Have you ever seen that movie?
I've never seen that movie, but it looks fascinating.
Oh, man, does it look cool, right? Because it's like they're on a train, but then you realize they're not really on a train. It's all fake backgrounds. I was like, I've never seen a Max Ophuls film. I know he's one of the great directors. I've never seen one.
And he kind of tips the ending a little bit about how, like, it's really a tragedy that, you know, Joan Fontaine is a poor woman. Maybe Louis Jourdan is not there, and it's just never going to happen for her. And so there's a tragic scene at the end at a train station. I'm a big Joan Fontaine fan, so another one I wrote down. Going to have to try to track that one down.
Yep. This is where he mentioned Scarlet Street, which you mentioned, the Fritz Lang one, and then Detour by Edgar Ulmer, which is for anyone who doesn't know Edgar Ulmer had so little money to work with that he couldn't even afford to cut film at a certain point. And so there's one scene where he literally just fades and it goes blurry. And then it moves over to another part of the set because he had to keep the shot going in one shot. And you're like, it works, right? Stylistically, it works.
I mean, Detour is brilliant because it's like, I'm pretty sure that this is a truly unreliable narrator. And so you blur in and out and it's like, maybe that's where he's like starting to make things up. That's great.
That's a great thing.
Yeah. And I'll say at the beginning when he's talking about Val Lewton, Scorsese says, you know, when less money was spent on a movie, there was more freedom because producers weren't like, so you were allowed to try to do all of these tricks. And so he talks about how Cat People is really about the repressed sexuality of women back then, even though it's Cat People. And then he said something which I want to get your take on. He goes, really, it's all about psyche. And so Cat People is as important, could be considered as important as Citizen Kane in film history, which I don't know if I would go that far, but that might be
a little much, but yes, I mean, Cat People was, and it was a big hit. So, I mean, it connected with audiences for a very minimalist movie. And he shows a bunch of scenes from Cat People, which, again, if you hadn't seen it, it makes it look like, wow, this looks fantastic. And I love that it ties back in with the band, The Beautiful, at the beginning, because they're, that's sort of like their story. And all the stuff he shows from the Jacques Tourneur directed movies with Val Lewton is all that stuff is really, really great. He shows a clip from Gun Crazy, which is a low budget movie about these two kind of Bonnie and Clyde gun runner, crooks, and they rob a bank. And there's this great bit where these cops are chasing the man and the woman, and the woman's driving, and the guy doesn't want to shoot at the cops, and it's the woman going, "Shoot, shoot! Why don't you shoot?" And you can see that he doesn't have enough intestinal fortitude to resist her, and so he's shooting at the cops, knowing they're going to get themselves in so much trouble. That clip is just so good.
Yeah. Yeah, that movie's great because obviously doomed crime lovers, a lot of great scenes in that. And the whole point is that he is an unbelievable marksman with a gun, but has vowed never to like kill a living being. And she's screaming at him to shoot the cops. And ultimately he shoots the tire, right? You know, so that they go skidding off. But he clearly didn't want to do it. And at one point, she says something like, or he tells her, like, you can't shoot somebody just because he's slow or he's not moving fast enough for you. And she's like, why not? Right. So and she's crazy.
Yeah, that whole thing is just so good. And then he has something from Kiss Me Deadly, the Robert Aldrich film, which is the Mickey Spillane thing, which has an incredible ending, which ties into the basically a nuclear bomb goes off at the end of that movie.
Bomb goes off on like a beach house on a
So
beach,
good.
which is wild.
It's good. So it features a very young Clarice Leachman in that movie, by the way, who gets tortured to death in that film. It's unbelievable. And then so he moves and he continues on with he talks about Silver Load, which is a Western directed by Alan Dwan, where it's about a guy, I think it's Joel McRae, who is framed for something he didn't commit. And it's basically an allegory for the McCarthy hearings. And the villain of the piece is named McCarty, for Pete's sakes. And then he ends up, Joel McRae's character ends up getting exonerated, but for the wrong reasons, right? So it's like he's being vilified for the wrong reasons, and he gets freed for the wrong reasons, as if the whole thing is just one big joke. And that is another one that like I desperately want to see. And 30 years hence, I still have not gotten around to it.
And again, he's like, this is a dirt cheap Western that has no reason to be this good. And then you look and Dan Duryea is in it, and you're like, well, these older guys have to do something. He plays McCarty. And again, in the clip they show, he gets killed, right? He dies at the end, right?
Up in the
As
bell
part of his
tower, I
escape,
think.
yeah, falls down the bell tower.
Yeah.
So.
Again, it's just another one. As I'm going through this, I'm like, God, I gotta see that. He shows a clip from All That Heaven Allows, the Douglas Sirk film, with Rock Hudson as the kind of young hunky, like landscaper. And he's romancing Jane Wyman, I believe, is a lot older, and it's sort of this sort of scandalous thing. And I love the ending where she's left him because she can't withstand the judgment of her neighborhood. And what does her family do to fill her life? Gives her television.
Gives her television.
And I love, and he's like, there's a line where he's like, life's rich pageant is all on this television, and it's so sad. You're like, this is supposed to fill in for the love of her life is television, and it's a movie coming out in 1955, right as television is starting to kind of really gain ground, and it's movies just sticking a shiv in there saying, no, this is the opiate of the masses. It's so good.
It's a good scene too because they start at the beginning where she has invited him to a party.
Yeah.
And one of the women is like, I know that I've met you before. And he's like, yeah, I've been like pruning your trees for 3 years. And then all of a sudden it's like nose up in the air. I have to be somewhere else, right? And so you can understand that like Jane Wyman is like, at one point she's like, they'll get used to it. And Rock Hudson is like, I'm out.
Yeah.
You've got the wrong ideas. So.
I love that lady. She's such a like a Margaret Dumont kind of person. And when he says that, she's like, oh, like it's like I don't even know that woman, but I know if I look her up, she probably has 75 movies where she plays wealthy dowager because that's what you did back then, right? You were good. If you weren't a star, you were good at that thing, and they just made you do it in 700 films because they were cranking that many out. So and that lady was great. Okay, yes, then. That's so good. One of the films that he gives a lot of space to is Bigger Than Life, which is James Mason again, about a dad who gets hooked on cortisone. Now,
Cortisone.
was cortisone really that dangerous back then? Because in the film, it's like it's almost crack cocaine in terms of what it does to James Mason.
I will say I sought this one out because he says that it's basically like an inborn steroid, right? And so it's not like an opioid or a benzodiazepine or anything like cocaine, but he goes crazy.
He really does.
And you can get like they call like steroid madness if you're chronically on it. But but like super long term. And even then, it's not like this movie, like literally has him like injecting himself and then going bananas, which doesn't make much sense to me, to be honest.
All right, fair enough. It's a terrific movie. It's in color, so it's kind of another film noir, but it looks like an Americana type drama because it's widescreen and it's in color, and they live in this very kind of Tony suburb. And it's, as you say, James Mason just goes batshit nuts, and he's planning to murder his own child. And there's this is another film that for no good reason it has bled into my life, because there's a scene where he's at the dinner table with his wife and the son, and he starts yelling at his wife, and he's like, in my mind, we're not married. I'm not you're not my wife. I'm not your husband. I'm here solely for the boy. And for some reason that just tickled my wife. And so every so often we have some like fake argument, and Kelly will just go, I'm not your wife. You're not my husband. It's just like, it's James Mason swinging for the fences. And it is it's such a great, crazy ass movie.
Yeah. Of course, it's the classic. He pulls out the Bible and he says, like, you know, and God said to Abraham, kill your son Isaac. And then the wife is like, yeah, but then God stopped him. He's like, God was wrong.
God was wrong. You know,
God was wrong. And
so, yeah, it's so like, good. It's oh, my God. So it's awesome. So good.
It's so awesome.
Oh, my. So another clip that they talk about is from Pickup on South Street, the Samuel Fuller movie, with Richard Widmark as a pickpocket on South Street of Philadelphia, my stomping grounds, who ends up stealing stuff from involving the Russians. And it, of course, becomes sort of this Cold War thing. And then there's this amazing, amazing talking headpiece with Sam Fuller, an old Sam Fuller. He looks like he's made out of granite, right? And he looks like he's up 400 years old. And he talks about that he was at Sardi's, which is just like fantastic, right? They're at Sardi's. And he's with the head of the film studio, which I believe he's talking about, Daryl Zanuck. And they're eating with J. Edgar Hoover, right? And apparently in the movie, the FBI agents try and get Richard Widmark to kind of go along out of patriotism. And Richard Widmark doesn't care. He's a crook. He doesn't. And he says something about, don't wave the flag at me. Don't wave the goddamn flag at me. And Hoover is like, that line's got to come out. That line has got that. You can't have a character say that. And it's Samuel Fuller telling the story about Daryl Zanuck, saying Zanuck actually stuffs it back at Hoover and says, that's what this character would say. And that is not, we are not going to change it, because if we change it under your instructions, that's propaganda. And we don't make propaganda films. And I'm like, can you think of the age you and I are living in right now?
Yeah.
Right? And imagine the head of a movie studio telling the government, eat shit. We are not changing the film because that is not what we do. And you're like, wow. You know, wow. Amazing stuff.
Have you seen that movie?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, it stars your girl, Thelma Ritter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
As someone who just wants to have enough money so she can have a nice funeral.
That's right. And she's like, I know all of the pickpockets in this town, and I'm telling you, the only one who could have done that is Richard Widmark, right?
Oh, it's such a great movie. It's such a great movie.
Before we move on, I forget which director said it, but at one point, one of the guys says, like, the moment you preach or try to teach, you are making a bad film. And God, some comic book writers need to hear that too, right? But I thought that was also great, right? You've just got to tell a good story, and you can get these messages in there, but you can't go over the top. I thought that was awesome.
Yeah, one of the great, again, from all these clips we're going on and on about, but one of the other really nice parts of this documentary is that it features a lot of interview footage with these guys, right?
Yeah.
Who, of course, all of whom are now gone. And a lot of this footage is them in their senior years. And like I said, like Samuel Fuller or Nicholas Ray, I mean, they look like they're 500 years old, because I mean, and the
Yeah.
one, I think it's Alan Dwan is the one, he's got the cigarette dangling out of his mouth while he's
Yeah.
trying to talk. And it's so fantastic that, like, in an era when recording these people was record, it took a lot of work, right? You had to like get a film camera and record them. It's not just, you know, it's not even, it's pre even, you know, VHS tapes, let alone having to be able to do it on your phone. But like getting clips of these guys and having them talk about their art form in like 30 seconds, again, a minute. And once again, I said this earlier, finding this stuff, like, where did they find it? Where would you find a clip of Sam Fuller talking about making Shock Corridor? Like, where do you even
Yeah.
think to look to find that?
Yeah. Or Fritz Lang saying that, you know, nobody believes in God and the devil anymore. They only worry about physical pain. So all of my movies have to be about how physical pain is, or the fear of pain is what drives people. Is like, where did that come from? And he also, like, I guess like eye patches were a big deal back then. I don't know how many directors have an eye patch, but you know, you're right. How did Scorsese even know about these? Who knows?
Right.
Yeah.
So the last one I want to mention in this section is he shows a clip from 2 Weeks in Another Town, directed by Vince Vanelli, which is actually a sequel of
Yeah.
sorts to The Bad and the Beautiful, which is, I did not know existed. I did never knew that there was a sequel to Bad and the Beautiful. And I've since seen it. It's okay. It's not
It's
as
okay.
good as you kind of hope that it's going to be. But there is that great scene of Edward G. Robinson talking to the producer. And he's like, if you give me another 3 days, I'll make the film better. And the guy's
Yeah.
like, I know you're not doing it. He's like, don't you want your name on the best movie possible? And the guy's like, no, I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't care about that. That's been so good. And it's he plays a director who kind of knows he's over the hill. That's
Yeah.
the gist of that, is that he knows that his best days are behind him and he's still trying to do it. So then Martin Scorsese moves on to the director as iconoclast, which is the directors who just made their own, like, just burn through their own path, and how some of them survived and some did not. And like one of the ones who didn't, Erich von Stroheim, because he talks about that Erich von Stroheim's, like, virtually every Erich von Stroheim film was cut, reduced. You know, famously, he shot Greed, which is like 9 hours long, and like six
Yeah.
hours of it were cut out and it lost forever. And he shows a scene from The Wedding March. He shows a scene from I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang. Have you ever seen that one? I'm a Fugitive from a Chain Gang.
Yes. Yeah.
One of the great final shots
One of
in
the best
all of
final.
cinema, right?
Yes.
Just straight up one of the great Ice Steel and Fade
I
to Black.
steal fades
Holy
into.
shit.
Yeah. Holy crap.
Oh my God. And then he showed, you know, and then again, he talks about like the more famous version, I Have a Fugitive from a Chain Gang. And then he talks about Hell's Highway, directed by Roland Brown, again, like a forgotten director, which is the same subject, which is about chain gangs. And apparently, like, these films led to changing laws about
Yeah.
chain gangs because of the cruelty. And there's this great scene where I think it's Richard Dix is the star of that, where he's a prisoner and he's about to get whipped because of some transgression in the eyes of the guards. And they look and they see on his back is a tattoo from his time serving World War I. And they
Yeah.
realize that they're whipping a veteran.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I've never seen Hell's Highway, but boy, again, amazing scene. It makes me want to see the rest of it.
Yeah. I think the guy just looks, it's like, well, get on with it, right? And he pauses because he sees the tattoo. Yeah. Solid.
He shows a clip from Marlene Dietrich's The Scarlet Empress,
Yeah.
which was a series of films that she directed by Joseph von Sternberg, which are these incredibly baroque, you know, ornate costume dramas. And they show a scene from that where she's bedding somebody down, and then she basically says to the guy as he's leaving, send the next guy up. And
Yeah.
you're like, 1934 they were doing this?
1934. Yeah.
Right? And he has this great quote from Sternberg where Sternberg says, I am every single person in these movies is me, n including Marlena. and no one knows that better than Marlena. And I'm like, wow, look, what a great quote to find from a guy saying, these are all versions of me that I'm putting on the screen. Just
Yeah. Have you
amazing.
ever, I haven't seen Scarlet Empress, but I did see The Blue Swan. Have you seen?
I have not seen any of their films. I have not seen
Oh,
any of.
and that is one about an older guy who just gets completely smitten with Marlena Dietrich and completely loses his way because he's so obsessed with her. And worth seeing. That's the only one I've seen.
All right. You know, again, it's just like
Yeah.
I've only had 30 years.
Yeah, yeah.
He then finally does show a clip from Citizen Kane and then pairs it up with the Magnificent Ambersons, which, you know, Meg, I still hold out hope we're going to find those missing reels from the
Yeah.
Magnificent, not at version, not via AI, F that, the
Yeah.
actual film, but, you know, who knows someday. He talks about Charlie Chaplin. He talks about Ilya Kazan. He shows something from Otto Preminger's Advice and Consent, which, have you
Yeah.
seen that movie?
Yes, I have. Gene
Oh
Tierney.
man. Oh, that's right, Gene Tierney. God, I love that movie. And it features a scene in a gay bar
In a gay bar,
in a
right?
1962 film with giant movie stars. It features
With
a scene in a gay bar. It's just.
and is all about like how politics is all BS, right? As Charles Laughton is like, I want to block this guy, but I'll make a deal to get him in as the in the role that you want. So, yeah,
It's that
awesome.
is that's another movie that's it's not streaming anywhere and it's never been put on Blu-ray. And I'm just like, why is this film, you know, and it's Charles Laughton's last film as an actor.
Yeah.
I'm like, why is this film like kind of like unavailable? You know, it's very, very frustrating because I love to recommend it to people, but it's like, I kind of really can't really find it.
Yeah.
He shows a scene from Paths of Glory, which is my single favorite Stanley Kubrick movie. The ending of that film where
Yeah.
the bar girl is dancing to the veterans and
Crying,
they all
yeah.
start crying. He shows something from like Preminger's The Man with the Golden Arm, which is of course dealing with drug addiction very early
Yeah.
on. A scene from The Sweet Smell of Success. Once again, I had not seen that film when I saw this documentary, and he finds a clip that makes you just want to see it so bad because it's
Yeah.
Burt Lancaster lacerating a guy at his like a politician, just absolutely cutting the guy down to size.
Yeah. And I don't think I had seen it when I first saw this documentary and sought it out. And that's a, I mean, you want to talk about a rough film. That's one of those ones that is just engrossing, but there, I don't think there's any character in it that you're like, oh, that guy's an okay guy, right?
Yeah, right.
They're all pretty terrible.
Yeah.
So.
He mentions Billy Wilder. He shows a clip from 1-2-3, which is one of my all-time favorite movies. James Cagney. It is just an absolutely hilarious comedy, but it's set in Germany, and the wall literally went up while they were making the film, quite literally. And it's making fun of communism and all this, and it was considered offensive and not funny. And now it's like you look at it now, you're like, this is so prescient. Right.
Yeah.
And he was making it like it's a riotous comedic performance from James Cagney.
Jimmy Cagney.
James Cagney. It's so good. And then it starts moving a little bit, like kind of right up to the point again where Scorsese comes in. It shows a clip from Bonnie and Clyde where you see after they rob a bank and they shoot a guy, and we see the guy take the bullet in the face. And it has this clip from Arthur Penn saying, if we're really going to do this, we're going to show it. We're going to show that when the human body gets violated by a bullet, there's an enormous amount of blood. It's not sterile. It's not neat. It's messy and ugly. And they show you just that very thing of the guy getting it in the forehead and how it explodes. And it's, again, it's a startling, startling clip.
Yeah, and then the other scene they show is, of course, the end where they're riddled with bullets from the machine gun, right? As if to say, like, and we're not going to make it one bullet, like 80 bullets get put into Warren Beatty, you know?
As they flop around and stuff like
Yeah.
that. Oh man. He shows Kubrick's Lolita. Have you ever seen Lolita?
I have.
What do you think of that one?
I have. I mean, I think it's a rough movie to watch because of the topic that it is, but it's James Mason again. It's poor Shelley Winters never seems to catch a break. Peter Sellers, right? So I think it's one of those ones worth seeing. But again, it's not one of those ones that I seek out. I'm with you, by the way. I think Paths of Glory, like if he had died after that, he would still be considered a brilliant filmmaker. That movie is fantastic.
Even with all of his epic masterpieces after that, which is one after the next, Full Metal Jacket, The Shining, Barry Lyndon, which gets shown, he talks about Barry Lyndon quite a bit, actually, near in the kind of the final minutes of this movie, of the documentary. But there's something about Paths of Glory, the fact that it's 93 minutes, right? It's so atypical of his films, and it is so cutting and so to the point about the dehumanization of people via this government and its military authority, and what it does to people. Again, it was banned, I think, in France, because it's talking about the French army, and it was banned in France for 30 years or something because it seemed deemed so offensive. It is absolutely just a startling movie, and it's not one that, like, people don't think of it versus The Shining again, Full Metal Jacket, or 2001, or Doctor Strangelove, or Clockwork Orange. I mean, my God, the list is just unbelievable. He shows a clip from Faces by John Cassavetes, and once again, he finds an amazing piece of John Cassavetes where Cassavetes just says, "All I really care about, and that all my films are about, is love. That's it. Is how we love each other, how we don't love each other, how love is received, how it's given." And he's like, basically, nothing else in life interests me but love. And you watch that clip, and I think if you read it, it could sound very treacly, right? It could sound very bromide. But first of all, it's coming out of John Cassavetes, like one of the coolest people, to like walk the planet. But there's something about the way he says it that it doesn't sound like that. It sounds incredibly profound, right? The way he's sort of like, why do I even want to think about other subjects? It's all this. It's all about human interrelation. And it's, again, where do you find that? Where do you find a clip of John Cassavetes basically saying, here's what all my films are about in 30 seconds?
I gotta say, like I've seen very little of Cassavetes, and so I think that's sort of like a hole that I have to fill.
There are, I've seen a couple of them. It's very funny to me that if you go and you go to Criterion's YouTube channel and you watch people go to the Criterion Closet, I'd say one out of every two people that gets to pull films pulls the John Cassavetes box set. They must be constantly running off copies of that because they're just going through it. So it's everyone's like, oh yeah, I got to take the John Cassavetes box set. By the way, I will mention, I must give it proper context because I don't want it to sound bad. My wife Kelly hates John Cassavetes solely because she hates him from Rosemary's Baby. Like, she's such a shit in that movie that even though she knows he's a brilliant director, anytime someone mentions him, she just kind of goes, ugh. She hates him as Guy Woodhouse so much in that movie.
That's awesome.
And
That's freaking awesome.
I pointed out to her that that role was almost played by Robert Redford, and I'm like, babe, Robert Redford could have been ruined for you for life if he had played that part, not John Cassavetes. John Cassavetes didn't star in that many movies after that, but yeah, she just loathes him, and I'm like, it's just a performance. She's like, I know it is, but still, I just just hates him so much. And so, Scorsese wraps up with a clip from Ilia Kazan's America, America, which is one of his lesser known films. I don't think I've seen that one. And then with John Ford's The Grapes of Wrath. And that's when he gets up to the point where he's like, well, this is about when I started making movies and I feel like these are my friends and I can't quite be objective. And he has this great metaphor where he's like, this is a museum, but we can't go into every room. And there's something about the way he says that that makes me say, I could watch another 4 hours of this, Martin. You want to keep going?
Yeah, because he then rattles off. He's like, let me tell you the people that I haven't talked about. Sam Peckinpah, Alfred Hitchcock, right? He's just rattling off these names. I'm like, I want to know what you think about those guys. Like, give me another. You're exactly right.
Yeah, it is an unbelievable achievement, and it wraps up. And I'm going to run the clip at the end of this episode, so you know what I'm talking about. But it ends with it's him sitting in the director's chair, and he actually even recommends other film documentaries. He talks about there's a 17-hour documentary about the silent era, like just that, like which is like wow. But the camera moves in closer to where it is like there, right? It is like his brow and his mouth are like right at the edges of the frame. And he has this really incredible quote. And again, this was written by Scorsese and Michael Henry Wilson, who is listed as co-director. I don't mean to slight Mr. Wilson. I don't know how much of it, you know, he's directing versus Martin Scorsese, but nevertheless, Michael Henry Wilson is listed as co-director and co-writer. But he mentions where he says, Scorsese says, he talks about that his original career was going to be a priest. He was going to go into the clergy, and he ends up becoming a film director. And he says, I don't think that those two things, the church and the movie theater, are necessarily that far apart. And he says, I think it's the reason movies are still a powerful art form is because it taps into the human need for people to share a common memory. And I thought that is one of the most profound descriptions of movies I've ever heard, to the point where I have now stolen it because I have now done a couple of live on-stage film introductions. That's the quote I use. Now, I give him credit. I don't pretend that I wrote that. I make sure I say, as Martin Scorsese says, but I think that quote is so brilliant because to me, it's like, yeah, that's what it is that's why you want to share movies with people. That's what you want to share a common memory. And there aren't that many documentaries I can think of that I actually get emotional watching. You know, mostly documentaries to me are, especially about films, they're more intellectual exercises. It's like, oh, just show me a bunch of movies that I've never heard of. I don't know. But ending on that is, I just find it just incredibly touching.
And I think that that's why I still try to go to the theater and see things in a crowded theater to sort of like get that communal feeling. Or when I tell friends, like, this movie spoke to me because of this scene or this shot or this actor or this theme, right? And then they watch it and you talk about it. That's exactly. I use movies a lot and I use quotes a lot, just like it sounds like just like you do, right? To sort of as shorthand or metaphor or ways that you're able to sort of convey your feelings. It is a religion in some ways, but maybe that's too strong a word.
Right, but I mean, it's the idea that you are. It's kind of funny because, like, you think about, like, if you go, I mean, you and I've been married for a couple of years now, and we are, neither one of us is single. Let's put it that way. Neither one of us is single, but like, I've heard people like say a knock on a date saying like, oh, you go on like a second date, you take her to a movie because it's like, well, you're not talking, right? But it's like, yeah, but you're sharing this experience together. And if it's a good experience, if it's not just some piece of crap, if it's a really good experience, you come out and you're like, we had this experience together. We went on this journey together. And I, as you say, I've been going to see a lot of repertory stuff lately, and it's been fantastic. And I mentioned this on the feedback episode I did not re recently, where I went and saw Blues Brothers, and I heard people laughing at jokes that I have internalized for 40 years now. And here I'm hearing it laughing like it's fresh, you know, or Rear Window. And it's like, it's been so satisfying, right? It's been so satisfying to have those experiences. And just the way he was able to put that all into just a couple of sentences. And it's the kind of thing where this documentary, I have now watched this almost every year for 30 years. I think every so, like, pretty much around a year, I go, you know what? I haven't watched it. And I watched the whole thing, even though it's
Yeah.
almost 4 hours long, but it's because it's got so much in it. I don't always remember where it's going. I don't remember what clip is next or whatever. And it remains fresh, even though this is 4 hours long and 30 years old. And that's just a remarkable thing for any documentary, let alone something about movies, which I already know so well.
Yeah, agreed. And I'll say it didn't feel like 4.5 hours.
Oh, no.
This was one that I just, flipped the disc, right? Put in the next one and just watched all the way through. It's super engaging. You
it
know,
really
I
is.
was not playing on my phone while it was happening.
Right.
Because
yeah.
you don't want to miss anything, you know? So people should seek it out for sure.
Absolutely. Like I said, it is a little hard to find. You can get it on DVD. The DVD is, as far as I know, is not out of print. So you can still order it, I think. I don't remember. It's been a while since I had to order one. But I think it's still in print. But for some reason, I guess it's the clips. They can't transpose it up into Blu-ray. I don't know. It deserves to be on Blu-ray, for the love of God. And why it's only on Canopy, I don't know. But it is there. And if you have Canopy, again, it's free and it's totally worth it. So it really is one of the foundational pieces, I'd say, of my development as a going from someone who likes movies to being like an appreciator of the art form. Cause
yeah,
he just introduced me to names that I have never, you mentioned like Johnny Guitar, you know, I'm like, I never seen Johnny Guitar. Still haven't seen Johnny Guitar, but it's when I go through when I'm on my way to Jaws, for the 90 millionth time, I'm like, oh, right
yeah.
below it is Jay and Johnny Guitar. I'm like, I gotta watch Johnny Guitar sometime. Do this.
No, it's true. And even stuff like, you know, ones we didn't mention, there's like a Lee Marvin movie called Point Blank, directed
Point
by
Blank.
John Borman, that he shows a clip that I'm like, man, I like John Borman's other movies. I've never even heard of this one. Like,
oh
how did
my
I
God, that's amazing.
This one and I haven't seen it. So,
oh, Point Blank is so good. Oh my God. So I wasn't planning on asking you this, and I don't mean to throw you because we do our notes, but I am just curious before we wrap up here.
Yeah.
What film, maybe it doesn't have to be the film, but you could just name one. If you could see any of these on the big screen, what one would you think you would love to see? It could be something you already have seen it, but you want to see it on the big screen, or something you've never seen and you see the big, what one of these you could, if you could pick one, what would be one that you would be like, oh man, I'd kill to see this on the big screen?
Oh boy, let me just scroll through and sort of let me see. I know it's so hard. I'm
because
gonna
I
pick
know
one.
you've seen Lever to Heaven, right? You saw that on the big screen.
Oh,
Once,
I've seen
didn't
Lever
you?
To Heaven on the big screen. I forced Anna to go with me. I think that I'm going to pick two movies that I haven't seen, because I do think that would be, I would want to see it. One would be that Colorado Territory that we talked about.
Okay.
I've seen High Sierra a million times, and this is a remake of High Sierra, but it does have those vistas that I think that you would want to give that sort of space. And then that Shock Corridor movie just
Oh,
looks
Samuel
like.
Fuller, yeah.
Yeah, that
Ku
just
Klux
looks like
Klan. Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah, right? You know, where Scorsese says, this is his way of saying America is an insane asylum, right? You know, and you're like, that seems like it would be an experience.
I'm sure it would be. I think I would love to see, I've already seen it, but I would love to see Bigger Than Life on the big screen. I just think watching James Mason just eat the scenery and spit it out of his mouth, and I think would be just such an experience, right? To see it. But that's, I've seen that movie. For one that I've never seen, I feel like maybe the Silver Load, the one you were just were talking about, that Western, because that looks it's such a low budget film, right? It's like a B Western, but yet the director Alan Dwan, like, brought all of this kind of high-end camera work to it, and it looks so much more expensive than it really was. So I think I might go with that one, too. It probably looks really pretty. And it's in color, so it looks just amazing, you know? But it's like, it's a film you've never heard of. So, yeah, I think that would be one of them. So Hey, I said, this has just been something that I've always wanted to talk about because I could just, if you've been listening to this, we've just been going on and on and on about clip after clip after clip. This is like in a live document. You can feel Scorsese's joy of mentioning, just showing you, here's this thing, here's this awesome thing. And it just exudes the passion that he has for it. And it's just such a beautiful thing. And I wish more people knew about it. And so that's what we're doing. I was so glad that you fell in love with it. And it's something we could just talk about back and forth. Like, oh, have you seen this yet? Have you seen this yet? I don't know. And so I don't know. I'm just so glad we finally had a chance to do this, Ange, and just talk about this documentary that we love so much.
And I'll say that it's always great to talk to people that love films the way that you love films, and I hope the way that I love films. Just to sort of, because then you can, it is this shared experience, and you saying, "Oh, you definitely have to see that." That means something, right? So I can't thank you enough for letting me talk about this and talk about these movies that I love.
Absolutely. So, okay, wrapping up here now with the exit question, even though this is a different formatted episode, we're still doing an exit question. So, my exit question to you is, Martin Scorsese, aside from all of his classics, has carved out for himself quite the career as a documentarian. I mean, he hasn't just made one or two, he's made, I think, about a dozen really well-regarded documentaries. And it's like, if he never had made a fiction film, he might have had quite a career as a documentarian. So aside from this film, what would you say is your second favorite Martin Scorsese directed documentary?
I think he did Man in the Shadows about Val Lewton. Did he do that?
I think he produced it. I don't know if he did. I never know about when you're directing a documentary, what that even really means if you're assembling clips. You know what I mean? I never exactly know how you define that, but he is involved in that one, the Val Lewton documentary, because he's a huge
So
fan of Val
I
Lewton.
think that's probably, I think he even does the narration of
I
it.
think he does. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm going to hope that counts because
Okay.
that's definitely mine.
Okay. My answer, I generally don't have an answer for the exit questions, but my answer would be, and I am playing a little bit of favorites here, is the No Direction Home, the Bob Dylan documentary. Obviously, I am massively interested in the subject, but it's also it's assembled by Martin Scorsese. Like, you can tell it's assembled with his eye. He even narrates one part of it. He actually plays Bob Dylan at one point, and it's his voice, which is great. But the reason I love that documentary so much is because it features extended footage of Bob just talking normal, which you don't, as a Bob Dylan fan, you don't get a lot of, right? He's inscrutable. But he's in this documentary. Now, Scorsese didn't shoot that footage, he was handed it to him. But he knew what to use and he knew how to edit it. And he intersperses it with clips of people talking about Bob Dylan and stuff from the 60s and then stuff from later and then back and forth. And it's just, there's lots of Bob just sitting talking. And Bob's an incredible storyteller, an incredible raconteur, and he's very funny. And when he's at ease, he's a great interview. It's when he's being, I think when he's sometimes he kind of puts the mask up and you're not getting anything. But when he's being real, he's fantastic and he's really funny. And so that's my, I mean, he did one with Annie Leibovitz, Fran Leibovitz, one of my favorite people. They did the Pretend It's a City documentary, which is great. He did one on George Harrison. He's done a lot of great documentaries, but that No Direction Home is just, that's another one that I can watch. It's like 3.5 hours long, and I can just watch it just over and over again because it's just so well put together. So that would be my other choice. But this is still always going to be my favorite, A Personal Journey Through Movies with the American Movies with Martin Scorsese. So, Ange, as we're wrapping up, why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internets?
My username is Dr. Ange 70 on X and Blue Sky and Instagram. And if you're looking for my comic book nonsense, I run a Supergirl blog called Comic Box Commentary. 17 years old now, Rob. My God.
We have got to get you at that premiere of the Supergirl movie. That's been one of your online efforts, is getting James Gunn to notice you. And I am all in support of this. I think you should absolutely, if we can make that happen for you, we should make that happen.
Well, thank you.
And so, of course, thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of this show on fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can find the show on Blue Sky at Fade Out Pod. If you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, you can go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So a big thanks to Monique D, Donald McWaters, Mark Balbus, plus David S. Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, Al, and Mike Atchison for their support of the Fire and Water Podcast Network and Fade Out specifically. So two other things I want to mention before we wrap up. One is if you are so inclined, please go to Fade Out's page on Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. I really would appreciate it. It helps. There's so many movie podcasts. Every review helps with the algorithm. So, and there hasn't been like a new review in a little while. So I really would appreciate that. And then secondly, I'm going to give everybody a peek behind the curtain a little bit. We know that Ange is a literal lifesaver and that he is a physician, but he is a lifesaver when it comes to podcast guests, because originally Ange and I were going to do this episode as a bonus show. I've been doing some bonus fade outs occasionally when I have the time. And I thought, well, this is off the normal format, so I'll do it as a bonus show and I'll just do the regular episode on a subjects, films, and then we'll do the bonus one. And I had this month's episode all planned. I don't want to say who it was on, but it was on a famous person, and I watched a bunch of their films and I did some reading, and then the guest that I had scheduled for months in advance just sort of ghosted me. Just did not give me any indication that they didn't want to do the show anymore. They just stopped responding. I don't know what happened. But the problem is with this show is that when I pick a subject and I start doing work on it, it's a lot of work because I'm watching dozens of films potentially. And when a person cancels on me at the last second, it leaves me high and dry, because now I've done all those months worth of work and I don't have a show. And so all the research I've done kind of gets thrown out the window, and I might decide to, like, maybe on Blue Sky announce, because it's happened to me twice this year, actually, where I've had a subject and I watched a bunch of their movies and then the person just decided without telling me they don't want to do it anymore. And so that left me with no episode. And as someone like me, who insists on putting the show out when I say I'm going to put it out, that really drove me nuts. So I asked Ange, would you be willing at the last second to do this idea that we've been talking about doing? And Ange stepped up. So Ange, you are a literal lifesaver, and you are also a podcast lifesaver, because without you, there would be no episode at all. So thank you very much, my friend.
Well, you know, I always feel honored when I'm asked, and I'm more than happy to help out whenever I can with the gang.
Well, thank you again. Thank you very much. I really do appreciate it. So, and everybody, please thank Ange on Blue Sky, because again, without him, there would be no episode of Fade Out this month. And who knows, maybe that material that I did all the research on will come into play in a later show. But we have this awesome episode talking about this awesome documentary. So thank you all so much for listening. We'll be back with another episode next month, but we reached the end of this particular script. So for now, it's time to fade out.
Actually, when I was a little younger, there was another journey I wanted to make. It was a religious one. I wanted to be a priest. However, I soon realized that my real vocation, my real calling, was the movies. I didn't really see a conflict between the church and the movies, the sacred and the profane. Obviously, there are major differences, but I could also see great similarities between a church and a movie house. Both are places for people to come together and share a common experience. And I believe there's a spirituality in films, even if it's not one which can supplant faith. I find that over the years, many films address themselves to the spiritual side of man's nature. From Griffith's film Intolerance, to John Ford's The Grapes of Wrath, to Hitchcock's Vertigo, to Kubrick's 2001, and so many more. It's as if movies answered an ancient quest for the common unconscious. They fulfill a spiritual need that people have to share a common memory.